Hello, everyone. Welcome to the AI podcast. My name is Athir Gautami, and my guest today is Mikael Huss, who is co-founder and principal data scientist at Codon. Welcome, Mikael.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Great to have you here. Mikael, what is AI?
Getting into it right away, huh? Yeah, I think AI is a discipline, scientific and engineering discipline, that aims to make machines or computer programs perform in a way that would be perceived as intelligent if it was a person. And what is then intelligence? Well, I think it has to do with problem solving, accomplishing goals in the world. Yeah, roughly something like this.
I really love it. I mean, I'm not sure if everyone would parse the words the way I do. Like when you put perceive, which is very scientific, you're protecting yourself from the definition. And since I know you're a scientist, or have a background as a scientist, I'm not surprised. I love it. So, Mikael, with this AI hype, I'm sure that you have been involved with a lot of projects because you're running a consultancy company focusing on AI data science, right?
Yes, indeed.
And there's so much happening. Could you tell us a little bit about the development for like the last 2-3 years, how things are changing, how you are perceiving company's ambitions toward being AI driven? The perception is that things are basically kicking off. Is it something that you're actually observing, or do we have different perception from reality? Please share with us your thoughts.
Yeah, interesting question. So the past 2 or 3 years, I think, have come with quite significant changes, both in AI techniques that are, we all know something new is coming every week, but also in the economic situation and the AI maturity of our clients and so on. So 3 years ago, it felt like it was a bit of an open field still. We were able to talk to clients and quite quickly come to a conclusion. Yes, we should do a project and we'll run it now. Whereas today, I think the field has matured. There are many more providers, and clients are considering their options, looking at different alternatives, and it's a different ecosystem. Of course, technologically speaking, I think you can't really avoid talking about before and after November 2022 with ChatGPT coming out, which was a watershed because, like, let's say, regular people, in quotes, finally started to realize what AI can do. We had done similar things before with, you know, BERT and other language models. And we had been using GPT-3 as well, actually. But nobody sort of normal knew about those. So 2022, November, changed a lot of things. What else could I say? I mean, I think these language models are, of course, where the biggest leaps are taken. The visual part had already been developing quite fast, and I think those tools were already quite mature when we started. And now it's LLMs, and who knows what's next. Maybe we'll come into that later.
So what do you think? I mean, before 2016, around 2016, is a lot about data science, analytics, insights, you know, for different applications, you know, understand your customers, you know, churn prediction, you know, recommendation systems, etc. But of course, it's been a lot of focus later on image generation. You know, we've seen it like from Stability AI and the DALL-E 2, etc. And now LLMs has, you know, they have taken over, you know, to the point where I think there are many people who perceive LLMs as this general AI tool. So they don't talk about AI. They talk about LLMs to solve other problems, basically, which has nothing to do with the language model. What do you think about this development?
Yeah, I totally agree that many people are conflating a bit. And also the phrase generative AI, I feel, is often used as synonymous with LLMs, even if that is not true at all, actually. Yeah, what was the question? Sorry.
So what I'm wondering is, yes, this the development and the perception, how things moved from, it's been like a lot of about data science, analytics, then it was a lot of focus on basically all kind of image processing tools, and then, you know, everything was about, you know, images and video suddenly, and now it's about LLMs, which basically disturbs the real definition of AI, but also takes attention from all the possibilities that you can actually do with, in particular, machine learning to solve other problems that actually has nothing to do with language per se.
Yeah, I agree with this sort of timeline. And I also agree that it's taking away attention a bit from, no pun intended, taking attention away from other applications. We still have a very large fraction of the real business problems that are tabular data, you know, and we haven't really had the same kind of progress on that kind of data at all, as in image analysis and language. But people don't really talk about that. I've seen lately some papers where they try to use LLMs on tabular data as well, but I think it's a bit dubious, at least the ones I've seen, because you would have to cram a lot of data points in some cases into a prompt and then potentially pay for that. And yeah, it seems a bit unnecessary, but who knows what will happen in the future. There are some interesting ways to use transformer models for tabular data that are not based on sort of modeling language, but I think they are still in a primitive state.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, it's like it's a different thing trying to use the language models, whether they are large or small, as an interface, which is fine. But this is where I see it stopping. It's not like going to solve like a problem of predicting, you know, how much you should purchase of a certain item to have in stock to optimize, you know, your sales. That's really different kind of data. And just to clarify for the listeners, what tabular data could be, it could simply be your Excel sheets, basically, that you work with as an example. So yeah, this I think is kind of problematic, because I have been consulting for a while also, and you have your consulting firm. And my personal perception is that people are now not really they are not looking for the right thing. They really think that, you know, LLMs and generative AI, as you said, which are like used in a mixed way, is kind of problematic, I would say, for the companies, because they might not get the solution they want.
Yeah, and I think, as you've already hinted at, there is this perceived progression that we had some techniques before, and now we have these techniques, and then maybe people feel that the previous techniques are outdated or something like that. But in fact, they're not in many cases.
I would say in most cases.
Yeah, maybe most cases.
I mean, it depends, you know, on your use case. But I've really seen, you know, some kind of descriptions of some projects describing something that has nothing to do with language models. And they say, yeah, and we'd like to have someone who is expert in LLM, generative AI, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, I would say it's almost shocking, but maybe not fully surprising, because if you do not have at least, you know, some expertise in your company to basically define the right requirements, then that what happens. What would your recommendations be to companies? They really don't have the real expertise. What should they do?
Well, if I talk from our company's perspective first, we like to really like dig into the business questions and try to understand them quite deeply before we propose the techniques to solve it. It's usually one of the most difficult things in a project to define the problem properly. So I guess I would also suggest to the companies that they really think about what they want to solve and like what is the question, and only then try to look for technique to solve it, because it's very easy to get a bit blinded and we should use this shiny new thing. But the problem is the most important. it's also not always easy to know exactly what you are trying to solve either. It happens that we or the client thinks we want to do X, but when we go deeper into it, it turns out that they only wanted to do X because they wanted to accomplish some other goal Y, and it might have been easier to start with Y instead of X.
That's an excellent observation. I agree with you. Sometimes you really need to ask questions. Why do you want to do that? And then you realize, but this is much better data to optimize. We should use that instead, for instance. So that's actually a great observation. All right. So, Mikael, we have already now touched on LLM. So let's get it out of the way for a while. If we can, I'm sure it's going to come back. Now, looking at the trend and how fast things are developing, let me start by asking, what are the recent developments that excite you post-November 22?
Yeah, good question. I have a lot of hope for open source language models. I know they are not quite at the same level as the best closed source ones, but I'm hopeful that they will be quite good. I also think it's really interesting with these very compressed LLMs that are coming out now with more and more compression, you know, going from 32-bit to 16 and now there is one bit.
Yeah.
I think that is very interesting. I haven't worked with that myself, but I think it's fun, and I also think there are some interesting analogies there to neuroscience, you know, one bit sort of action potentials in the brain. It's interesting to think about, even if it, you know, it's mostly for fun.
Yeah. That's actually an interesting analogy, but do you really think that the neurons in the brain work binary? Because there are some kind of signals with maybe, I don't know, I mean, I'm not the expert in how the brain works, but maybe the signals can have different levels of power, and that maybe leads to some kind of quantization also in the signals.
So I actually did my PhD in computational neuroscience. And I mean, yeah, it's not quite binary in some ways. It's usually presented as like either you have an action potential or not. And it tends to be about the same voltage, but it could vary a bit. But also you can use sort of the frequency of these action potentials as a way to encode information also. And also timing, for instance, in some flies, you know, they're very quick at perceiving things, much quicker than humans. And that has been shown to depend on the timing of the action potentials. So, yeah.
When we say timing, like how fast they respond?
It's got to do with sort of exactly when the action potential gets generated. Yeah, that carries information about the object that they are seeing. So it's like a timing.
So what exactly, the timing and the action potential, I mean, where is it? I mean, when I say timing, I think about time.
Yeah, so I've forgotten about the details now, but like somewhere in the visual system of the fly, there are action potentials generated when it gets signals from the retina. And then it's got to do with like the exact time in a sort of cycle. If you think of a cycle between 0 and 1, if you generate something at 0.1, then that carries information. So it matters if it's generated there or towards the end of the cycle.
Oh, I see. All right. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. That's super interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, there are different ways to encode information in the nervous system.
Right. So do you think that exploring these kind of features could perhaps change the way we design the machine learning algorithms, for instance, the neural networks?
I think it could. People have tried, probably in many ways that I don't know about also. But so far, these artificial neural networks that we know about now have been the most successful. Yeah, but I think definitely in theory, it should be possible to improve them in this way. And I think there are companies who try to do that.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, I mean, the current architecture of neural networks has not been fixed all the time, because we see new architectures that some kind of improvement of the current architecture that performs better than the predecessors, right?
Yeah.
So we actually see that the change of architecture leads to improvement. And this kind of new architecture that has with whatever, you know, it's timing or frequency or whatever, this could be potentially very useful.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah, it's true. We see new architectures like the transformer, for instance, which is based on attention, which is also, you know, a concept from cognitive science or psychology or biology. So it's definitely useful to draw analogies like that.
Right. Yeah, I think it's great to get some inspirations from nature, especially when it comes to intelligence. Try to somehow understand how the brain works, even if it's a long journey, I guess. But it's very, very exciting. So, okay, Mikael, so do you have like other interesting developments that you're following very closely that you think are very exciting? Actually, I have one question before we move on regarding the open source LLMs. So what do you think we could lose by having these open source are more compressed? Is it like in the pure language performance that when you have a conversation, it responds in a weird way, or there are other losses when you, you know, go from these, you know, well-known closed source to the open source models?
Yes, so far I've just felt that the closed source ones from OpenAI and Anthropic, they are just more powerful at generating good outputs that I'm looking for. And yeah, it's mostly based on subjective feeling. But the problem is that many clients don't want to use them because they are closed source, and it entails sending information to some company, you know, in the US or elsewhere, and you don't know what they will do with your data. Yeah, so far they have just been more powerful, and they're also quite good at Swedish, actually. So
yeah.
I haven't found that yet in the open models.
That I can imagine, but let's not think about the other languages than English, just if we stick to that. Have you like tried open source models where you couldn't like have a reasonable conversation with? I mean, of course, they're not that big. They have not memorized the entire internet. But beyond that, say you want to use it for customer service, would it be enough, do you think?
Yeah, probably. I mean, if not otherwise, then you can fine-tune them, because with the open models, there are tools for fine-tuning them in an easier way, where you can also control a bit more what happens in the fine-tuning, rather than just sending something into OpenAI through their API and then something magically comes out. So I think it can be enough for sure.
Right. So if a company would like to do some fine tuning with some open source model, I don't know if it's, you know, Llama, 7 billion parameters, etc. Is it easy for them to do?
Well, probably not without some help, right? You still need someone who can do the work. The tooling is not really ready for the average user. But I also don't think it's that hard if you know a little bit of, you know, Hugging Face and PyTorch and stuff like that.
So what would you need? What kind of hardware do you need to do it, you know, yourself?
Well, of course, it depends on the model. So I guess the minimum is something like an RTX 3090 card, or in some cases, one of the Macs with this M2 chips, if you want to fine-tune a model of, let's say, 7 billion parameters. But yeah, the larger the model, the more hardware you need, of course.
Yeah, but that sounds doable, right?
Yes, and in some cases, maybe you can make do with smaller models as well. We used to do some pretty useful stuff with BERT models also. They are much smaller, depends on the use case. We also do some work with protein language models, and those can easily be fine-tuned because they are usually less than 1 billion parameters. So
what are protein language models?
Yeah, Good question. So as a refresher, so proteins are made of amino acids. There are 20 different amino acids in nature typically, and those are the tokens. So it's a language model with 20 tokens, plus maybe some extra tokens for, you know, start and stop and gap and stuff like that. And then you train language models by sort of churning through all of the proteins that we know about that are recorded in databases. You can do a BERT model where you randomly mask out some tokens, or you can do GPT models. There are both types. And this gives a model that somehow has that models what kind of proteins have evolved through history, through evolution. So it kind of knows about what kind of proteins should exist, if we put it in that way.
Yeah. And what do you call them, language models?
Yeah, that's a good point. They are called protein language models. It's, I guess, not really a language in the regular sense. It's
is it just a kind of like a series predictor, basically?
Yeah, it's like a sequence predictor. People have done foundation models for proteins, and then you can fine-tune them in order to optimize some property of the protein, like melting point or solubility or something like that, with a model on top of the pre-trained language model. But yeah, it's a bit like with the regular LLMs. You can have BERT models for sort of classification or regression, or you can have GPT type models to generate new proteins. There are also diffusion models for generating new proteins, which are quite popular now, like in stable diffusion, for example.
Right. So this is actually one of my issues. So there could be some company looking for, you want to have the technology behind the language models. I say, yes, we want to have an LLM for this thing. We called it actually protein language model, but it's not really a language model. It's not language. It's just that basically that you have an algorithm with an architecture of a language model, since the language is actually sequence of tokens, right?
Yeah.
Sequence of words. And you have something similar for the proteins, is sequence.
Yeah.
And you feed in the sequences and you get predictions, and predictions of whatever you are actually aiming for. You know, as you mentioned, the different, what do you call it, properties of the proteins. So this is exactly where I think people maybe should use another language, instead of saying like it's a language model, talking about the architecture behind it that you can actually use for other applications. I mean, what's your point of view?
Yeah, to be honest, I hadn't really considered that, but you have a point. The most common of these models that I will not call protein language models now were trained by Meta Research, and they call them ESM, evolutionary scale models, which is maybe a better name. But yeah, it's not really a language in the strict sense.
All right, cool. We clarified this.
Yeah.
This part. Great. Now going back to my previous question before I interrupted myself, and that's regarding what other technologies that you're following and that you think are exciting?
I'm pretty interested in causal inference, causal models. I mean, I wouldn't say there has been some breakthrough in it, really. It's more that I think it's something that we need to have in order to figure out why some systems are actually performing in the way they are. Often when you do, probably you have also seen this, like often when you work with pretty complex tabular data, it could be like some industrial process, for example, with different sensors and settings and stuff like that. You find a lot of patterns, but it's very difficult to untangle like what is causing what. Everything is connected. You would like to be able to figure out like what comes first. And here is where causal inference comes in, and people are working on it. But I think it's still not ready for prime time.
No, definitely not. I mean, this has been a hot topic, like going back and forth, being some progress happens, people do research, and then it dies out, and then some new results. But it's definitely extremely central for building real intelligence, like system that can do reasoning and planning And, you know, there are so many people that are really afraid of AI taking over. This piece is still missing. So we definitely need not to be afraid of AI taking over. I'm not saying that there are not some, you know, aspects of AI that we should really be careful with. That's not what I'm saying. Just saying that an AI that can take over, I don't think it's possible today because of that we don't know how to do causal inference.
Right. Yeah. And I often think about, like, I'm not going to name any names here, but sometimes when I come to a new client and see what data they have, what data they don't have, and what they want to do, I'm always thinking, like, how on earth would, like, an AI be able to take over here? Like, how would that happen? Because it's so messy. No one knows where anything is, what the different tables mean. So, yeah.
I mean, that's a great example. And I'm sure that many people would come up with many examples. They say, hey, yeah, let this chatbot solve it. Nothing would happen. But I think what's happening is that these chatbots, they are so good at deceiving humans that they are really intelligent, especially when it comes to language. Like in simple conversations, you know, they have definitely passed the Turing test. So, which is basically about, you know, having conversation with a machine without being able to tell that it's actually a human behind it. And we are there. But I think it stops there. That's the big difference between perception and reality, I would say.
Yeah, you're right. They are very good at sounding convincing.
They're always very confident, right? Mm-hmm. It's really interesting stuff. All right, so you're excited about causal inference. You're following on the subject. Is it anything happening today regarding this area?
Well, I'm not sure. I've looked a bit into some work that Microsoft has done with causal inference, but I haven't had the chance to really use it in a, you know, sharp way in a project. They have one package that's called DoWhy that came out a number of years ago, but then they have continued on that and are trying to do some, what's it called? Now, I'm not sure of the term, but sort of identification of the... So in DoWhy, for instance, you need to provide the possible arrows between different things. Like you need to state, like, I think these things are related, and then it can sort of find the weights on the arrows between those things. But recently they've been publishing some papers about also identifying these relationships from the data. And I think that's interesting, but I haven't had the chance to try it in a real project.
Oh, that's super cool. Actually, I would like to hear more about it. Maybe we can look at it together and then we can record another episode to discuss these things, because this is actually very exciting. But I have not heard about the research from Microsoft in this topic.
Mm, yeah, I have a very good ex-colleague who is working there on this now. We can hook him up as well.
Okay, cool. Sounds great. So any other topics that you find exciting that are happening today?
I'm always following, you know, tabular data. Is there anything that is better than, you know, XGBoost? Short answer, probably not. But I think it's fun to follow. And I also like to follow a bit research on explainability and interpretability, which I think is getting more difficult now as the models get larger as well. I just saw today one of my colleagues posted that OpenAI has released a repository where they have some kind of tooling for looking at, they call it debugging transformers, but it has some tools for looking at kind of which neurons are activated in response to which words or concepts. But I didn't have time to look at it yet. That will be fun.
Okay, and what's the usefulness of these tools?
Well, so for certain applications, for instance, medical applications, I think there can be requirements or at least an interest in knowing, for instance, if you have an X-ray image or something, you have a model that says, yeah, this is probably something that you should look at, then it can be useful if it can somehow indicate why it thinks that. And I mean, in general, I think it can be good for debugging models also. If you use certain explainability techniques that tell you, okay, these features were what led to this decision, and then you realize, oh, but that feature, okay, that's actually a feature that we cannot use in production. It existed in the training set, but it had been it wouldn't be something that we had in production, and it actually happened to contain information about the label. Then you realize you have to throw that feature out. This type of thing happens quite often when you haven't thought through what information you will have in the future.
Super interesting. Mikael, what do you think of AGI? When will it happen? Will it happen in 2 years or in 5 years or more?
I think that's such a difficult question. My definition of that is even more fluffy than my definition of AI. I don't think it will happen in 2 years for sure. Yeah, more than 5 years, let's say. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Which is very much related to the things that you're interested in. Causality, you know, explainability is also part of it. All these, you know, connect to the ability to reason, which is, I think, necessary to have AGI.
Yeah, reasoning, definitely.
Super cool. So, Mikael, now we have arrived to the final question of the episode. And that is, if you have any recommendation of a book, movie, series, or documentary with AI as a topic.
Yeah. So one of my favorite writers is Philip K. Dick. And even though I don't know that he has any book that has AI specifically as the topic, but I think he often uses that as a theme. For instance, in his book, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Which is the book that Blade Runner was based on. That one is really good and asks questions about, like, you know, what is really the difference between an intelligent android and a human? Do our human morals apply to the android, etc.? And he has some other books as well where there are sort of AI-ish entities. So I recommend his books, Philip K. Dick. And I also like, probably this one has come up before, but I do like the Black Mirror TV series, especially the earlier seasons, because it asks a lot of interesting questions.
Yeah, Black Mirror is, I think I mentioned that in the podcast before. It's really one of few things and probably the only series that really make me almost feeling depressed after each episode. I watch two.
Yeah.
And it somehow gets to me. I don't know why.
Yeah, definitely. It hits pretty hard in some episodes.
Yeah, and that's probably the one that I watched, the first one, and yeah, some other one, you know, about, you know, how you do rating of each other.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's horrible.
I mean, you get a heart attack by the end of the episode. So, but I mean, it's extremely well done. So if you do not get the feelings that I get, enjoy.
I saw at least the first two seasons. And I thought they were good. And then I've been dipping into them a bit now and then.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, you know, it's very thought-provoking. So from that perspective, I like it. But unfortunately, it gets to me too hard. So I don't think I'm going to watch any more episodes. Not for now.
I see.
But I know there are many people who love the series. Well, Mikael, thanks a lot for being our guest in this episode. I really enjoyed our conversation. And I hope that people also, you know, got some learnings also from our conversation discussing on, you know, what the hot cool stuff that are coming up, especially to build AGI.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really enjoyed the discussion as well and hope it's useful to some listeners.
Definitely. I really enjoyed that. So I'm sure that there are many other listeners who enjoy that too. And to all listeners, please do send us your favorite topics that you would like us to discuss, but also suggestions on guests that you would like us to host. So you can find us on our website. So it's www.ai.com. ai-podden, P-O-D-D-E-N, .se. So please reach out to us, and if there are any topics that you would like us to bring up, or if you have any questions, just don't hesitate to reach out. Thank you, and thank you, Mikael.
Thanks.